Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Lisa Napoli, and here's a word you don't hear every day.
This word escheatment entered my vocabulary.
That's Mr. Stephen Tucker with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Stephen's one of many people who recently had to learn that $10 word. Here it is again.
This word escheatment entered my vocabulary.
So here's a quiz. What is escheatment? Is it A, when your unclaimed property gets turned over to state government sometimes without notification? Or is it B, a scarring of the gums after exposure to diethylene glycol? That's the poison that's been found in some toothpaste from China. Or is escheatment a spell in the new Harry Potter movie? Go ask a kid. They know. Or don't, and stick around. The answer is just minutes away on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Have I got news for you? There's a bunch of cash out there, and it just might have your name on it. How can you tell if it's yours? You've come to the right place. I'm Lisa Napoli, in for Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
It's hard to imagine you could ever forget where your money is. I'm not talking about your wallet. I'm talking about stocks you bought or bank accounts you opened and then lost track of. There's billions of dollars of unclaimed cash out there, and if that money is yours, you have a right to ask the state to give it back. Then, of course, there's the dark side of the story, what's been happening in California. We asked Marketplace's Steve Henn to investigate.
Right now, state governments have $40 billion in unclaimed property. Bank accounts that have been abandoned, stocks, bonds, and jewels left for years in safe deposit boxes. But I've always wondered, who exactly forgets that they have thousands of dollars in assets sitting somewhere? I mean, what kind of idiots are these people? Meet Stephen Tucker. Thing is, Tucker's not an idiot. He's a pretty savvy investor who started working for Intel in the late 70s.
I was a European product manager for their systems business.
He took advantage of the employee stock plan and by the mid-1990s owned more than 16,000 shares in the company. Then in 1995, Tucker noticed something odd.
I realized that I actually hadn't received stock certificates from the last split of the stock.
He contacted Intel.
And they said, oh, that's okay. We can issue the certificates. Just give us the certificate numbers for your existing stock, which I did. Their response was, there are no stocks certificates with those numbers. That's when this word escheatment entered my vocabulary.
What was that? Turns out if you own stock and the company loses track of where you live, they're legally required to list your investment as unclaimed property and after a few years turn it over to a state government. As Tucker found out, states like California can seize your assets without you ever realizing it happened. Tucker's next step, he called California's unclaimed property office.
So I contacted them, and I said, I want my property back. And they said, well, here's the thing. We've probably sold it.
For $25,000. At the time, it was worth 10 times that. Not something to laugh about. Today, it would be worth more than $1 million. Tucker's now 55 and says his dream of an early retirement is gone.
Honestly, that's one of the biggest challenges with this situation is I'm not sure what I could have done to have prevented this.
Unclaimed property has provided billions of dollars in revenue to California and other states in the last decade, and states have become much more aggressive about going out and getting it.
They use it for things like general fund overages, education, transportation, padding whatever budget shortfall they may have.
Tracy Reed's an attorney who helps defend companies from unclaimed property audits. She says the less property that's returned to its rightful owners, the more money that flows into a state's coffers. Years ago, California stopped publishing the names of people like Tucker in the newspaper, even though California law requires the state to do that.
They're not the only state with this problem. They're the first state to be caught.
Before a company turns over property to a state, all it's required to do is send a letter to the owner at their last known address.
They're not required to Google it, to ask the post office to give them a forwarding address, or to do anything extra to find a new address.
So how do you make sure what happened to Stephen Tucker doesn't happen to you? Reed says keep careful track of your investments, especially after you move, or if a company you're invested in merges. If you don't, you could easily lose your property to the state where the new company is incorporated. But most important, make sure the companies you invest in always know exactly how to reach you. I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace Money.
We'll have links to some unclaimed property sites on our website, marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Steve Henn just told us how states get their hands on unclaimed cash and stocks. But now we turn our attention to another type of property that's a bit harder to lose, real estate. It is pretty tough to figure out who's in the driver's seat these days, buyers or sellers. George Manis is a senior writer at Money Magazine. Let's start with the basics, George. How do you read the market?
Well, the most important barometer you can look at of whether you're in a buyer's market or in a seller's market is the supply of housing on the market. As a very rough general rule, if there are about 6.5 months of inventory on the market, prices will roughly appreciate with inflation. If you have fewer than 6 months' supply of houses on the market, it'll be faster than inflation. And up around 10 months, you could have actually just prices falling.
How do I figure that out, though, as a consumer? Obviously, I can look around my neighborhood and see lots of signs, but how do I know how much inventory there really is?
If you're working with a broker, you should ask the broker, and the broker should be able to get you these numbers. What's also important, though, is isolating the market where you are. Pick the right neighborhood where you are. The same school district, similar types of houses. Then you can get a sense of what the supply is like.
So you do a loose comparison. I know I follow another one of your rules that you lay out here is as I shop for a house, I'm looking at how long a house has been on the market because that gives me a sense of how flexible the seller might be.
And that's another figure you ought to be able to get from a real estate agent or broker. Okay, the houses that are selling right now, how long have they been on the market? How does this compare to 6 months ago? How does this compare to a year ago? Very roughly, if these houses are on about a month before they sell, it's pretty much a seller's market. But if, you know, you get a little closer up to around 3 months of sitting on the market before something is sold, that's pretty much a buyer's market.
Mm-hmm. And of course, over the last couple of years, things were going in days in some markets around the country. So it's a telling sign that that's different. Another thing you're saying to look at is the broker. And I find that brokers are all relentlessly cheery and upbeat about the market. I guess it's their job to be that way, right? But how can I get an honest read from them about what's happening in the neighborhood where I'm looking to buy?
One thing that I found helpful, and I was just as skeptical of a broker's ability to report honestly, was a website called RealtyTimes.com. And it's a website where realtors who do pay to be on, who have an agenda there because they do want to drum up business, it's a place where realtors can rank the market, can rate how their market is going. And looking at the collective wisdom of realtors in an area should be able to give you a pretty good sense of how things are. I looked at one, for example, in Tampa, and things are bad in Tampa. And in fact, that's what it says on RealtyTimes.com. You know, be your own researcher. And it might be as simple as looking at all the houses that you pass on your way to the grocery store. And noticing that there is a for sale sign and just keeping track of it. You know, are they running a lot of open houses? Does a sold sign go up quickly? Is there a little sign that says price reduced? And you can sort of follow how things are going with particular houses in the neighborhood that you're looking at. You can give yourself roughly a good idea of how desperate sellers are.
George Manis is a senior writer at Money Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You'll find a link to George's article on our website, marketplace.org. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Now, that may be true, but here at Marketplace Money, summer school is in session. So far, our syllabus has covered the federal funds rate and earnings reports. This week, we focus on three little letters, PMI. We went to our local Home Depot to ask people what they thought it means.
I have no idea.
No, not at all.
Wow. Primary...
Some kind of insurance offered by a private contractor or a private company or private organization.
I have no idea.
Is this one of those things where I'm going to look really dumb on the radio?
What is PMI?
What is PMI?
What is PMI?
And now for a real definition. At the blackboard today is Greg McBride of Bankrate.com.
PMI stands for Private Mortgage Insurance. And where this comes into play is if you're buying a home or refinancing a mortgage and you don't have much equity in the property or you're not making a large down payment. This is an insurance policy that protects not the borrower, but the lender. Because you're making a small down payment, you represent higher risk to the lender. Therefore, they want to have an insurance policy that would protect them in the event that the borrower defaults. There are alternatives to private mortgage insurance. One that's been particularly popular in recent years is what's known as a piggyback loan. A piggyback loan involves simultaneously taking two loans in lieu of making a larger down payment. Many borrowers have gone this route in years past, but the dynamic is changing a little bit because of a recent provision in the tax code that makes private mortgage insurance premiums deductible for loans issued to certain borrowers in 2007. One thing to keep in mind with private mortgage insurance is that the smaller the down payment you make, the higher the premium you will have to pay for that insurance. For example, if you're buying a home for $100,000 and you don't have a 20% or $20,000 down payment, you're going to take a larger mortgage and subject yourself to private mortgage insurance. But if you're borrowing $85,000, you're going to have a lower premium than if you were, say, borrowing $95,000. That represents less risk to the lender. That lower risk means lower premiums on your private mortgage insurance.
Our teacher this week was Greg McBride of Bankrate.com. More summer school next week when we tackle that tricky concept known as short selling. A debt collection agency wants your money. What are your rights? Chris collects the information in the mailbag, and a Canadian woman takes on a rather demanding job.
They would call me and say, okay, in 2 weeks, you have to be a little Tibetan boy.
A day in the work life of a voice actor. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Lisa Napoli in for Tess Vigeland. After 6 years in the making, the Simpsons movie hits the screen later this month. Its creators have kept the plot top secret, but rumor has it one word features prominently in the script.
Don't!
That's actor Dan Castellaneta. He's the voice of Homer Simpson and one of the few voice actors anyone knows by name. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we introduce you to someone a bit more anonymous. We'll let her speak for herself in all her many voices.
The Turbo Diesel Jetta. Introducing Aquas Theater from Sharp.
Stouffer's Lean Cuisine. Do something good for yourself.
My name is Laura Teasdale. I'm a voice actor. I make my bread and butter doing voices. When I was little, I was always an imitator. I grew up in the East Coast of Canada, and we have strong accents there. So everyone around me had kind of an accent like that, you know, and they'd say, oh, get out of here, and stuff like that. And I would always imitate and copy. And then, of course, my teacher, who was very British, don't you know, and I would copy her quite a bit. And it was always something that I would get praise for. So as kids do, I just kept on doing it. I lucked into a job on a cartoon called City Mouse, Country Mouse. I played the kid in countries around the world where they would go and solve a crime. So they would call me and say, okay, in 2 weeks you have to be a little Indian girl. And then I would study for a week and learn it and try very hard to do that. And then the next time, in 2 weeks you have to do a little Tibetan boy. And I'm where am I going to learn this? I have to get a coach. And it was really challenging. And that was a really good opportunity. And it's given me a lot of confidence with accents. I guess the hardest things that I've done are when they ask you to do, they're trying to save money, so they ask you to do 20 different voices all at once. So 1 minute you're, oh, I'm a little boy, and then you're a very old Scottish lady, and your just brain is exploding. That is when you're really stressed out. My financial situation is crazy. Some years I feel like I'm rich, and some years I'm very poor. In my 15 years, the most I've made is about $80,000 Canadian, and the least is about $18,000 or $20,000 Canadian. It's really hard not to be silly in the studio because we are doing crazy things. And we're doing it so earnestly and so seriously, trying to get right the way that a kid says, I pooped my pants. No, sorry, I'll get that again. I pooped my pants. You know, it's so ridiculous that after the fifth take, and plus the oxygen gets pretty thin in these little glassed-in studios, we can't resist. One of the funniest things is when an actor that has a very well-known voice, like Danny Brochu, who I worked with recently, he plays Buster Bunny from Arthur, and to hear him use that voice and say, oh, damn it, you know, or it's so funny to hear him say something dirty or something grown up. It's so fun.
Don't you want to see what Laura looks like? You can see her photo at marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
Costly living spaces bring us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, shareholder mansions. Shareholder mansions refers to the title of a new study. It theorizes that when a prominent CEO buys a fly new crib, investors pay for it. Researchers looked at almost every fat cat in the S&P 500. When the boss cashed in company shares to buy a home, the share prices fell. Even if the CEO bought a huge pad with their own salary, same result, stock prices fell. So, the next time a CEO decides, this house just isn't big enough anymore, investors might have to look for a new home as well. The poorhouse. Got a box full of letters. All right, now it's that time in the show where we answer all of your pressing financial questions. Along with me is our very own economics editor and master of ceremonies, Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks for taking care of me my first time I do the mailbag with you.
Oh, this is a pleasure. This is a joy.
It's a pleasure for me, too. It's great to be here. Before we start with this segment, I'm going to ask people to take down our web address. If they don't know it already, I'm sure it's seared in their brains, marketplace.org. You can click on the contact button if you want to send us a question, or we'll make it easy for you. You can give us a call at 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. I've always wanted to say that on the radio before.
Okay. And now you get your chance.
And now I get my chance. We're going to start off this week with someone right here in our neck of the woods, Sarah from Los Angeles. Now, Chris, Sarah writes that she recently received a notice from a debt collection agency for an unpaid phone bill of about $250. After calling to find out what it was for, she learned that it was for an account that had been closed for 10 years back when she was in college and shared a phone line with three other people. She did admit on the phone that she recognized the address and set up an installment plan to pay it off. But now she's had some time to think about it. She's wondering if she's legally bound to pay off this really old debt. Chris, isn't the rule after 7 years that it gets wiped out? And does it matter that she's admitted this to the collection agency?
They can go after you for as long as they want. There is no limit on how long a company can try to collect on a debt. The 7-year limit is on your credit report. That we all know this. An old debt, it drops off after 7 years, right?
Right.
Depending on the state, the statute of limitations on being sued has nothing to do with the 7-year on the credit report. That has to do with, it can be 5 years, it can be 7 years, it can be 10 years, depending on the state.
Gotcha.
For most people, here's my advice. You get one of these, ignore it. If they become a pain, then you do everything in writing and you don't agree to an installment plan. You want them to prove that you really owe this money. They don't have the documentation. They have to go away.
But at this point, since Sarah's agreed to this, she's got to go forward, right?
Well, it sounds like she's already set up the installment plan. So, you know, she's already said, yes, this is a debt obligation that I have. Go ahead. Pay it off. It used to be that if you paid off one of these debts, it came on your credit report, it could cause you all kinds of problems. And they've straightened that out. So this really should not have much implications for her credit score.
But I think the real lesson here, Chris, is don't share a phone with other people if you can avoid it.
We have all learned that at some point in our life.
Okay. Well, if you are completely in the dark about a financial situation, Chris is here to come to the rescue. Click on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org, a very fine website, or call us at 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. All right, I might have to talk to our next caller off the air about how to get a bigger raise around here. She is a former human resources specialist who's given it all up to become a professional artist. Welcome, Cindy from Nashville, Tennessee.
Hello, Lisa.
Hey, Cindy, you know, I hear you're doing oil paintings, and I almost married an oil painter many years ago. So I have great admiration for what you're doing, and I think it's great that you threw in the towel on one thing to go the other way.
Well, thank you. Well, I figured after many years in the profession, if I didn't get about doing what really was my passion, then it would never get done.
Follow your love and the money will follow.
Hopefully.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Hopefully so, Lisa.
Well, so what is your question today then?
Well, it's kind of a money healthcare question. I have been getting my healthcare insurance through my former employer on COBRA. And at the end of this year, I need to make some choices around healthcare and continued healthcare. And several people have suggested that I consider an HSA, a health savings account. I'm not making a lot of money. Does doing a health savings account really make sense for me?
And we should point out, too, that you're 56 years
old,
Cindy?
Yes, that's right.
I've been in this position many times as a longtime freelancer. Chris, what do you think Cindy should do?
I have a couple of points. I'm a big fan of health savings accounts. Now, the health savings account allows you to do for an individual is put about a little over, in 2007, $2,800 into a special account as an individual. For a family, the number is somewhere around $5,600. It's pre-tax dollars. It compounds tax deferred. And when you withdraw the money for qualified medical expenses, it's tax-free withdrawal.
But doesn't it go away if she doesn't use it? That's what worries me about the HSAs.
It doesn't go away. Let's just say you put in $2,000 and she's lucky. Basically, you don't have any health care spending for the year. It rolls over to your $2,000 rolls over to the next year. You can put in another whatever sum of money you want to do, another $2,000, whatever, and the money continues to grow. And what happens is that if people are lucky and they have relatively low health care bills, the health savings account grows, and then you can use it in retirement to also pay for whatever medical expenses, Medicare, whatever doesn't pay for. So for individuals who are not covered by a corporation's plan, and particularly people who are making career changes, early retirement, the health savings account is probably the best plan that is out there. And the reason for that is the only affordable health care plan for an individual is a high deductible plan. And at least with the health savings account, you get to keep something. And then you can use that whenever you need to pay for qualified medical expenses.
Cindy, what kind of art do you make and how are you trying to sell it right now?
Well, right now, most of my art is landscape painting and plein air, which means you're out in the creeks, the streams, doing mostly smaller paintings because you typically have 2 to 3 hours to complete a painting before the light changes. I have a website, cindybaron.com. I'm trying to market it myself right now because art is such a competitive profession.
Good for you. Cindy, thank you so much for your question.
Well, thank you very much.
Great. Take care. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
All right. Have no fear, dear listeners. If you are completely in the dark about a financial situation, whether you are an artist or not, we're here to come to the rescue. Click on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org, or call us at 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. Okay, Chris, another email now.
Paint me the picture.
I'm
sorry. I'm sorry.
Very cute.
I couldn't help myself.
I would be an abstract artist if I had a paintbrush. I can't draw to save my life. Okay, here I'm going to paint you a picture from Bradley from State College, Pennsylvania. Brad is a longtime shareholder of a privately held corporation located in Pennsylvania. He started as one of the first employees and early on had been offered an opportunity to purchase stock in the company at a discounted rate. That's always a nice perk to have. Since that time, the company has grown and many changes have taken place. Most notably, they sold a significant portion of the intellectual property to another company, which Brad feels was not enough. The company president sold his shares into an employee stock ownership plan, and large sums of money are going unaccounted for. Now, Brad has never been to a shareholder meeting, nor has he ever read the shareholders' meetings minutes, but he wants to know what his rights are as a shareholder. Who can he speak with to find out what he's entitled to, if anything, Chris?
Well, he's entitled to a lot in law, but then I'm also going to add reality. Minority shareholders, they don't have a whole lot of rights in the real world.
No clout, yeah.
They really don't have clout. However, because the company does have an employee stock ownership plan, which comes under the Department of Labor regulations, there actually is more rules and regulations at work with this company. He should be able to get more information. There is a trustee that represents, mediates for the employees because there is a stock ownership plan. So my feeling is, look, you do have rights as a shareholder. You need to ask senior management when is the next meeting, what's going to be on the meeting. And you can talk about a lot having to do with the company at a shareholder meeting.
Would Brad have more rights if this was, say, a Google?
He'd probably be a lot wealthier. But here's the real right that he has as a owner of a publicly traded company, the ability to sell easily with a public valuation, with whatever the world out there thinks this is worth. With a privately held company, there are appraisals, there are companies that specialize in putting a value on the stock. And to use a real jargon term, the stock is not liquid. In other words, it takes time to sell that stock.
Well, if you've got to figure out a financial situation you think might take more time than you can spare, give us a call and we'll try to speed up the process. You can even put the number on your speed dial. It's 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. Or if you don't want to talk to us, you can email us your true confessions at marketplace.org. Just click on the contact button and pour out your heart. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Okay, Chris, it's true what they say about time flying when you have fun, because we've arrived at the last email of the day.
Okay.
Thomas from Timonium, Maryland. He writes that a friend recently suggested that he put some of his money into something called a dividend capture fund. Sounds kind of scary. While there seems to be some history to this type of investment, he's finding it pretty confusing. Chris, what is a DCF, and are the risks and rewards of it substantially different from any other fund that seeks to beat the market?
Okay. The dividend capture fund is a relatively new instrument, and I'm not a big fan of it. Now, what it is let's say a company announces a special dividend, a one-time payment, or they're just going to announce their regular dividend. What the dividend capture strategy is, you buy the stock in time to get the dividend, you hold it for the 61 days, and then you move on to the next one. So you're always trying to capture a dividend.
It's like flipping real estate in a way, except you're flipping stock. Okay, gotcha.
You know, I mean, to me, it's a lot of trading. You're just adding up a lot of trading costs. I prefer the strategy of, you know, let's go with a money manager. Let's get good companies that pay a good dividend. And I think that's a sound strategy. Dividends do matter. If you look at the gains in the Standard & Poor's 500 over years, even though dividend payments are down, you know, dividend payments are important. I'm a little bit skeptical of these turbocharged strategies such as dividend capture. In the end, I don't think they're worth all the frenzy. Buy mutual funds that specialize in finding good companies that pay a good dividend. That's a fine strategy. Once you start narrowing it down to sort of a dividend capture, I'd be pretty skeptical, and I don't think that's the way to go. They just don't pay off. It's not worth the effort.
So slow and steady wins the race is usually what we hear you say, Chris. And there you say it again.
And I say it again. And, you know, fact of the matter is, yeah, when it comes to investing, for most people, slow and steady is the way to go.
I like your philosophy, and so would my mommy, who is my financial planner. So there you go. We'll have to get you guys together. Okay, Chris, that's all we can talk about this week, so I'm going to let you go, but leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. I won't be here, but Tess will. Call 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. So much fun to say that. Visit our contact page on our website, marketplace.org, if you'd rather talk to us that way. Bye, Chris.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Travel in style without the hassles, headaches, or the huge bills. We'll show you how to flex your dollars.
Shoulder season is the period in between the high season and the low season. There are fewer tourists, there's better availability in the hotels.
And are warranties worth it? A price war might mean the price is right. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Lisa Napoli, filling in for Tess Vigeland. While she's on vacation this week, I've been hawking the euro as it reached stratospheric highs against the dollar. Not happy news for people like me who are headed across the pond later this summer. I know, summer is the worst time to go if you're looking for a bargain. If I'd just listened to my colleague Marketplace's Stephen Hoffman, I could have saved a bundle.
My wife discovered this incredibly cheap flight from Los Angeles to Buenos Aires. While we desperately wanted a vacation, we were still reeling from the cost of our wedding just last year. So we had to make a difficult decision. Stay or go.
Once again, we need all electronic devices turned off and put away before we can leave.
We used airline and credit card bonus miles to get an inexpensive fare. But what happens if you don't have miles to use? How do you vacation cheaply? Tom Meyer from Eurocheap.com says plan your arrival when most tourists are heading home. They even have a name for it.
Shoulder season is the period in between the high season and the low season. There are fewer tourists, there's better availability in the hotels. You know, if you go to Paris in August, for instance, this is the peak season for tourists, but there are no French people around. But if you headed south, if you went to Rio, for instance, it's winter there, but you can still go to the beaches.
So we went to Argentina in the off-peak season. We still needed to watch our spending, though. But as it happened, one U.S. dollar equaled 3 Argentine pesos. So just by going, we tripled our savings. In fact, travel expert Pauline Frommer recommends that before you decide where you go, look for the places that will extend the life of your cash.
It's very important to think about where the dollar is strongest, because you're going to be able to buy a heck of a lot more if you go to a country where the dollar is strong. For the most part, that's most of Asia, except for Japan and Korea, South and Central America, and in many parts of the Caribbean as well.
This skyline right here wasn't here a year ago.
That's Christina Wiseman. She runs a tour guide service called BA Local in Argentina. While some travel experts don't necessarily recommend using a tour guide, she arranged a lot of things that really helped our budget. An apartment to stay in instead of a hotel, and a cell phone rental instead of making upgrades to our own plan. A good guide can help you avoid costly and boring tourist traps.
We're in the Recoleta Cemetery in the neighborhood Recoleta in Buenos Aires. There are 70 national monuments inside the cemetery, and most of the presidents are buried here as well.
Eva Perón, is she buried here?
Eva Perón is here as well.
So we got a little history lesson for nothing. The cemetery visit, it was free. But there are those times when even the most frugal person will have to part with their green.
She's store life.
If you need to do a little buying, check out stores that participate in a program called Tax-Free Shopping. Again, Pauline Frommer.
Unlike in the United States, where taxes are added at the cash register, in many countries the tax is included in the price of the goods, but foreigners, those who are visiting the country and staying usually less than 6 months, aren't required to pay that tax.
Look for stores that have a sign posted, or ask the clerk before you buy anything. Next, all you have to do is fill out a short form and then wade through a specially marked line at the country's airport to get the final authorization.
What's the amount on my credit card?
164 pesos.
And how much is that in dollars?
I don't know. $55.
55 bucks is no laughing matter. That's how much I saved by participating in the program. I got the refund within a couple of weeks, but it's already going for our next vacation. Who knows where? I'm Stephen Hoffman for Marketplace Money.
You can find some vacation snaps of Argentina on our website, marketplace.org. And while you're there, send us a postcard of how you save money on the road. Just click on the contact link. Now that we've talked about travel overseas, let's talk about passports and the dreadful experience of getting one of those photos taken that wind up looking like a mugshot. Like many of us, Michelle Phillippe has issues with photography. She's working up a scheme to kill two birds with one stone.
I don't have a passport, but it's not sitting in a vault waiting to be processed by the State Department. My passport is hiding in a pile of junk on my desk, expired, because I can't afford to get my picture taken. I'm saving for my wedding. I realize the average American wedding hovers around the $28,000 mark. Ours is not going to be anything like that. But even so, it adds up fast. So I'm developing a plan, a way I can get the most bang for my buck and ensure success with a little old-fashioned multitasking. I want to look beautiful and effervescent in my passport photo, like Venus in a Pre-Raphaelite painting. When the custom clerk stamps my passport in a country, I want to be backlit. This kind of imagery costs money. Hairstylists and lights and wardrobe. Paris Hilton spent $10,000 on a hair and makeup session last year. That dramatically exceeds my budget. Remember, I'm getting married. I've had bad experiences with photo ID. I look like Satan in my college identification photo. My YMCA gym membership pic is worse. Fluorescent lighting left my face heavily shadowed. On the goddess to zombie beauty scale, I slide heavily toward undead. When my driver's license came up for renewal, I was determined to get a good picture. I got a new sweater, made a trip to the hairdresser, and practiced smiling while driving to get into character. As I stood on my mark, ready to pose for my DMV portrait, the woman taking my picture actually helped me fix an out-of-place hair. And though her tenderness gave me a fresh perspective on government involvement in my life, I have my doubts. I doubt if I'll be calm enough to sit still for any photo until my wedding day has come and gone. My fiancé and I just started interviewing photographers. A psychotic process. Now, I love photography. It's a timeless, beautiful art. But I dare you to stay sane while a string of strangers insist their work will immortalize the most important day of your life for thousands of dollars. Because in the end, the pictures are all you've got, and that's the selling point. And I don't want to look like the living dead wearing a marshmallow dress. So, all my styling dough is going into my wedding day. My carefully chosen artsy photographer will capture our ceremony. Then right after, they'll snap a shot for my passport in the garden while I'm wearing white. Effervescent. Efficient. Excellent.
Michelle Phillippe is an actor, and she works right here at Marketplace as our production office coordinator. Speaking of weddings, next week we'll have another installment of our series called Engaged. That's where Tess is following a couple's money march down the aisle.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
I have two words for you, planned obsolescence. The idea that products don't last forever has fueled a $6 billion industry, warranties. Walmart and Target are now undercutting warranty prices the way they do on the products themselves. Todd Marks is a senior editor with Consumer Reports. Todd, are these cheaper warranties a good deal?
It still goes back to the same basic tenets of what these things are all about. Extended warranties amount to costly insurance to guard against the very strong unlikelihood that something is going to go wrong with a product precisely at the time when the manufacturer's warranty is expired and the extended warranty is in place. You must remember, an extended warranty doesn't reach into infinity and beyond. It's for a very fixed set of time, anywhere usually from a year to maybe 3 or 4 years.
Still in all, Todd, there are some companies that do offer better warranties than others, right? All warranties aren't created equal.
Well, that's a big question mark because like all insurance policies are different, whether you'd buy them for your health, home, or family, the fact is that all extended warranties are different. What you were told in the store may not always jibe with what's actually printed on the paper. Sometimes they'll say, oh, yeah, we cover everything. Then you read the fine print and they don't.
You know, I know there are some people who love their computer warranties and wouldn't even think about buying a computer without them. Are there some companies, Todd, that offer better warranties, more useful ones than others?
Well, we only have a couple of exceptions to our don't buy an extended warranty rule, and one of them happens to involve a computer. It's Apple computers. Not because Apple computers are any less reliable than any others. To the contrary, they're quite reliable. However, Apple has cut the amount of time they offer to 90 days. They limit you to make telephone tech support calls. After that, you're going to pay $49 per incident. So if that's important to you, we certainly recommend considering that Apple extended care.
Todd, with Target, with the new pricing system that Target's offering for its warranties, what's the fine print on all of that? Obviously, they're trying to get me in the tent by dropping the rates.
Well, they're trying to simplify the process. However, from an actuarial standpoint, and what I mean by that is what insurance underwriters do all the time. They look at the likelihood of risk and the likelihood of failure. If a product is known to be trouble-prone and is going to break a lot, well, what happens? Either they stop covering it or they charge much higher premiums. Basically, they don't want to have to pay out because if they do, they're going to lose money. Remember, extended warranties can generate extremely high profit margins for retailers and those who sell them. 50% or higher of the sale of the warranty can be pocketed by the retailer.
Let me ask you this. I know when I rent a car with a certain sort of credit card that I don't need to buy insurance, does that kind of thing work the same way if I go out and buy a plasma television with a certain sort of credit card?
Well, that's another reason why you shouldn't buy extended warranties, because Most credit cards offer protection that extends the original terms of the manufacturer's warranty by up to a year if you purchase that product with their credit card. So that, and again, is adding insurance to what you already have.
Seems to me the easiest way around this is A, not to buy more stuff, and B, to keep a 14-year-old around the house who can fix things for you.
Well, that's always a good idea. It's also a very the smartest idea that we at Consumer Reports can tell people is to buy brands that have a reliable repair history, whether it's televisions, refrigerators, air conditioners. We have data on the brands and the products that have been most and least reliable. And while, you know, as they say in those commercials, past performance is no guarantee of future success, the fact is that when it comes to our frequency of repair data, brands that have proven to be reliable in the past tend to have better likelihood of good, long, outstanding, trouble-free performance in the future.
Todd Marks is senior editor with Consumer Reports. Thank you, Todd.
You're welcome.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts
is
say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It is time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help us sort out what is smart, what is stupid, and what's the straight story. Now, Chris, there's unfortunately nothing new about sleazy scam artists targeting the elderly. But when you consider that Americans over the age of 65 have a collective $15 trillion in the bank, you can see why the more nefarious among us are rubbing hands together to figure out how to get a piece of it. Chris, what's going on here?
Well, Lisa, we're at the beginning of the great boomer retiree money grab. I mean, an aging population has accumulated more assets than any group in history. The sum is phenomenal. And is it any surprise? We're seeing a lot of sleazy money tricks.
Everybody wants a piece of the action. But Chris, this week, two news stories put a fine point on the whole trend this way, both from different angles. One was in Kiplinger's, the other was in the New York Times.
Oh, you're right. And they really both got me really upset. I mean, the Kiplinger story showed how bad financial advice can slash the savings of workers who were downsized out of a job. They lost their job and they lose their savings. And then the New York Times documented lousy financial guidance to the elderly by advisors, which has meaningless titles as, get this one, registered financial gerontologist. Here's the straight story. The retiree motto for financial advice should be caveat emptor.
As it is for all of us. But Chris, that Time story really was upsetting. It revealed that in order to call yourself a certified senior advisor, all you have to do is take a correspondence course. What else did we find out in these stories?
Well, what the story showed is that the advisors were pushing products that earned them a high commission, even though it was a bad deal for the customer. And then the Kiplinger story, people are being downsized out of a job and they work at a company where they get a severance package. Boy, they get sold the siren song of high returns.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? High returns equals risky investments. A lot of times risky investments go bad. So much so, the National Association of Securities Dealers, that's what it used to be called. Now they're just called the NASD. They issued out an investor alert. Be careful of these people who are promising you high returns.
One of the guys in one of these stories said something like, most people do more research on their dishwasher than they do on the broker that they hire to manage their money. And obviously what you're saying is watch out for false promises of vast riches. How else do I check out these guys?
Okay, a couple of things. First of all, if you're unsure what to do, just put it in treasury bills. There's no credit risk. Your money is safe. You worked hard for this money. And then take your time to figure out what to do. Or you can go to any mutual fund company, major bank. You know, they'll all have a decent section that will lay out sort of basic financial advice, you know, how much in stocks, how much in bonds, depending on your age. And, you know, we can quibble about it. But basically, most people, they could just create a broadly diversified portfolio for themselves. But here's the truth. It takes a lot of work to find a good financial advisor. First, you know, you mentioned, you know, the certified senior advisor. What did you say? It was 2-3 days to get one of these
things? Something like that, yeah.
Something like that, you know, or a registered financial gerontologist. I just love that one. And I mean, here's two credentials that I like. Certified financial planner. or personal financial specialist. These take years to get, several years to get, and then there's ongoing education.
So know the difference between the acronyms that are behind somebody's name.
Absolutely. And then I'm a big proponent of fee-only financial planners. You pay for their knowledge. It's an expensive route to go, but boy, it makes me much more comfortable. And by the way, the kind of advice you want to pay for.
Chris, what's scary is in the Times story, they mention some of these rogue advisors who are attached to big and very legitimate companies. How do I wade through all of that? Because if I can't trust these big name advisors, wow.
Yeah. You want to stay in the financial world that I call KISS. Keep it simple, stupid. There are lots of financial services firms out there that thrive on selling you complexity. The products that you were talking about that were being sold, that were the annuities in the New York Times story, very high fees, very high commissions. These are expensive products. So warning bells need to go off. If you don't understand it, don't buy it.
All right. The Straight Story with our man, Chris Farrell. Thank you, Chris.
My pleasure.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the not-so-secret life of a financial blogger.
Unfortunately, I reveal so many details about my financial history that I need to be anonymous.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes and Nancy Fargali with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Lisa Napoli. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.